Michael, from the student's perspective, what are you hearing from this discussion so far?
The assessment impacts of high school standardized testing play out in discussions around access to post-secondary education. One of the things when the transition review study was done, and it was done looking at the question of why in Victoria, one high school, the Esquimalt High, were transition rates to college and university at around 20%, and why at Oak Bay High were they at around 80%, and what are the consequences, or what were the factors that led to that? And what it led to was primarily economic factors. Those students from families, or families of students in Esquimalt High, didn't see post-secondary education as a future opportunity for them or something they'd be able to afford. And based on that economic barrier, they then proceeded to not encourage success among their children beyond finishing high school. And largely because they feared having to say that they'd be unable to support them in their post-secondary educations. At Oak Bay, parents knew that they could afford to send their children to post-secondary education, and they encouraged them from a very early grade. Where that ties into assessment is that if you don't view yourself as going on to post-secondary education, getting A's and B's doesn't matter. Trying hard doesn't matter. All that matters is doing what it takes to get through high school. Once you're in the work world, employers, if with just a high school degree or a high school diploma, employers don't ask, did you get A's, B's, or C's? They don't look at your transcripts. So if you're not intending to go on to post-secondary education, you don't have the incentive to put in the effort to get the higher marks. And that alone will have a significant play in how schools from different socioeconomic areas play out in the ratings, especially the way the Fraser Institute does, and in the way the provincial government is currently moving in terms of standardized testing.
I can say in the United States, the high stakes tests start now in third grade. And in many states, at ninth grade, there's a real cutting point because students begin to experience the test that will take to exit high school. And so Linda Darling-Hammonds reported that for the first time in U.S. history, high school graduation rates are now dropping because students are giving up when they see in ninth grade that they're not going to finish. They have an incentive to walk away from school. The so-called Houston miracle, which has now been revealed for what it really is a primary venue for this, where Linda McNeil and Angela Valenzuela and other researchers have had in the literature for years that there was a huge dropout rate caused by these high-stakes tests in Houston. And they had evidence of that by going around and counting the number of students in homerooms in ninth grade, then going around and counting the number of students in 12th grade. And it made no sense what the Houston school authorities were reporting in terms of a lack of dropout. Well, the movement to discourage people from going on in education is picked up very much in that film, The Corporation. And I'd like to echo what Michelle said. That's a fantastic movie with roots here in Vancouver. It won the Sundance Award for the best documentary this year. It's playing around town. And one of the things that it illustrates is there is a set of values in the corporate structure that is counter to what persons like most of us in this room represent. There's a different motive for what we do, and it's really not right or wrong that they should have the motive and values that they have, but it's up to us to crystallize ours and to express ourselves in the public forum. Corporations do what they do, and they're efficient at certain things, but if persons like ourselves don't stand up and express the opinions that support the public good, then we can expect those other, more self-centered motives to prevail.
I'm reminded of a cliche that I think is useful, and that is that the meek may indeed inherit the earth, but the news of it will never get out. I think there's some truth to that. I don't want to go down the road as to whether people have an agenda for destroying public education, but I do think that there's no question that there's a value that competition is good, the end result of which will be the destruction of public education. And I'm reminded of somebody I followed as a school board chair who was from the business community, and his motivation for being on the board was that he had lived and worked in the UK and Australia and saw how divisive having large percentages of kids in private schools ended up being for society at large. and he thought that was bad for business. And I think that there are, in fact, some agendas that it is possible to connect with, that going down this road isn't going to be good for anybody in the end. I'd just like to add, in terms of end results of the assessment conversation, is that in the area that I've worked in tying to the literacy agenda, what we now call information literacy, that teacher librarians work on, the ability of kids to read, see on a screen, derive meaning, put it in their own words, and so on. The research in that area says that the most difficulty that kids have with technology in particular is that they're so trained in schools to find answers, they can't express the questions that are important to the search. And we have a serious problem with kids who aren't developing, you know, substantive question-asking abilities, which is critical to a democracy. And, you know, in those follow-ups that you mentioned, a year after kids are out of school and so on, it'd be nice to start to ask kids how many voted in their municipal or provincial or national elections and track that to improve that kind of thing to start with. It just seems to me that, as you said, we're looking at the wrong things, and there's ways that we can gather important information quite easily.
Well, how about performance assessment as a way around some of the more narrow forms of paper and pencil testing? Does the panel have any thoughts on whether performance assessment could come into the picture?
I think it's great. It's part of the current toolkit. I think the key for me is that teachers use a wide range of, you know, forms of assessment, and performance assessment is one important one. You know, that we ask kids to do things that are meaningful in the wider world. Coming back to something that Chris said, I don't just outright oppose any standardized testing, because I do think we need a mechanism for making sure that, you know, schools are serving certain populations of students well. We know that a disproportionate number of kids who are dropping out or not achieving at the level that we would want are First Nations, people who speak English as an additional language, people living in poverty, and so on. And so I think we want a mechanism that's diagnostic but not misused. And I think performance assessment can't be used in that way. It's very unwieldy, and by its very nature, I think it's not easy to standardize, and we probably wouldn't want to do that. So I think it's good, but it doesn't mean that we don't want to have this other form of assessment if it's used right, and we can hammer on the media not to take it out of context. That's some of the points that Michelle was making.
We'll be coming to you in just a few minutes. I'm putting you on notice now to start getting your questions crystallized, because we're about halfway through our session. Chris, performance assessment, have any particular?
Well, I guess one of the things that, you know, in an ideal situation, if our government was interested, like truly interested in, or at least from my own opinion, interested in following and documenting where children are, doing these assessments throughout, you know, it would be good to have something that actually follows students from kindergarten all the way up to grade 12 and perhaps post-secondary. If there was really some purpose for that, I think that would be one way to do it. It's not necessarily making them standardized, but it's looking at individual children, which comes back to relationships. But I think there's something really wrong for Indigenous students in particular when they when so many start out in kindergarten throughout the year, and then by grade four, if you notice, grade four is when grades start to come out, there's more and more a feeling for students of alienation, of not feeling as though they can be participants in the system, and that is interpreted as slow learner, there's something wrong with this student. And then as you go on further to grade seven, there's another foundation skills assessment test done there where students are still further marginalized from that. By then, children have, Indigenous in particular, have had years perhaps of LAC, classroom pullout, resource teacher time. And then when they hit high school, there's another, a further transition where the student is no longer meeting with one teacher but having eight, and then from grade eight and now to grade 10 where there's going to be more assessments done on them. It's going to further alienate, further socially marginalize these students, that by the time, you know, by the time they hit grade 12, there may be five students, whereas in the beginning, if you, you know, there may be like 300 across the, you know, in a small district of, you know, students who are of Aboriginal ancestry or the Lower Mainland, that by grade 12, they're gone. So, and I think that, you know, there's space and room for both types of accommodating, I think, you know, in an ideal situation and setting. There's got to be space for both.
One of the topics that we're addressing here is what are the impacts of current public policy, and when we look at Aboriginal learners and the low high school completion rates, one of the things that our organization is struggling with right now is the provincial government's move to reinstate fees for adult basic education. And we know that a disproportionate number of adult learners are Aboriginal students who are returning after having failed to complete, and we have a very serious concern that the move to implement fees in it. King Edward College, for example, they're talking about $280 a unit, which would be more than $1,000 a term for people who don't have their high school completion at this point, or if they do, are seeking to upgrade it in order to get into college and better themselves. And we have a real concern that we'll see a profoundly disproportionate impact on Aboriginal learners in the province.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that those who seek to complete a high school diploma as adults would be paying up to $1,000 a term for the ability
yes.
to do that? Well, that's certainly a lot of money, isn't it? Now, should we turn to the audience? Ginny's out there to flog everyone into joining in. You know, to some extent, these standardized tests, the language basements anyway, seem to simply be a reflection of whether or not a child was raised in a home that spoke standard English, and beyond that, whether they were raised in a home that spoke what we call academic language, a certain level of English usage, which we can address in schools if we choose to. We can have remedial work to add to children's vocabulary, the kind of words that allow a person to succeed on these sorts of tests, if we deliberate on that as a goal.
There is just one other part of an inclusive education for me that hasn't been mentioned. I know there's all kinds of ramifications for what I'm going to say, so I don't want to get into the political part. But there have been studies, for example, of Aboriginal kids and kids from lower income areas that are motivated to stay in school because of the rich range of extracurricular activities that the school provides. It gives them another reason to go to school. It gives them something they can be successful in. They aren't going to be graded for it, and so on. And I think that when we talk about inclusion, we need to talk about not just what happens in that 24 by 32 room or the building from 9 to 3, but the whole kind of program of activity that's offered for kids.
Thank you.
Just add to that quickly. I think we also need to look at what's happening in terms of cuts, not just in the education system, but other systems. So, I mean, I look at children with disabilities. You have a child that, let's say, has a parent who's getting a $6 training wage. MCFD services have been cut back, so it's more difficult for them to get the programs. That's the same child that comes to school, that we need to look at the whole child and what's happening in government, what's happening to them within various systems. But that's also part of inclusion.
Thank you. We're now going to go to the floor, and I'm going to go to this mic here, and then we will alternate. I think that's the way to go. So, over to you.
Natalie Lissick with UBC, and I represent, I'm president of one of the unions who represents workers at UBC. And we're noticing more and more of an increase with respect to technology replacing people at UBC who are dealing with students, particularly in the library system, whereby we're looking at more and more about self-checkout systems, robotic stack retrieval, and so on. One of the things that attracts people to work at UBC is working with the students and having that one-on-one contact. And I'll give an example. As a mature student, I decided to take the internet marketing certificate, and it was through a distance education whereby the entire course was through the computer, through email, website, and so on. One of the things that I really missed about in taking that course was the people contact. And so I'd like to get some feedback with respect to, or maybe some general comments with respect to how this is affecting students with respect to more and more technology taking the place of actual faculty teaching courses with the distance education, more of the technology being brought in with respect to accessing information rather than replacing people, or technology replacing people in the library systems to be able to work with students to access information. Not only on their learning ability, but also on their social skills as well.
Okay, who would like to take that from the panel? Okay, over to you.
I think the question came from the perspective of post-secondary institutions, so I'd like to just respond from that perspective, not the K-12 sector. And it seems to me that sometimes we get into the debate of technology or people. And I would say it's more a question of what the institution or the organization chooses to do with the technology. There are a number of libraries, for example, that have introduced a self-check-in, self-checkout, and so on, and reassigned that staff to work directly with customers. So it really depends on whether the agenda is cutting staff or using them in more effective ways. And with regard to distance education, I've just finished some distance education courses myself. And there is, to some extent, that loss of personal contact, but I think the question as well is what is being gained in access for people who wouldn't have access otherwise if they don't live nearby or can't go full-time or evening or whatever. So it's really a trade-off, and I guess what I'm saying is the whole area is so gray and it so much depends on purpose.
Well, if I can turn that last comment on its head a bit and put it in terms of what's being lost in terms of access because of distance learning. And what we find is that a lot of the decision makers who are very pro-distance learning and e-learning are those who are going back to, you know, who are professionals who already have one or two degrees. They're the bureaucrats who are doing maybe a master's degree via the internet or whichever else. And they enjoy that experience and they find that, well, maybe that will work for others. And apply that model across to younger learners who still really rely on the working with others to develop their learning skills. And what we're seeing in the post-secondary system is we're seeing rural and remote college campuses closing and having classes diminished and being replaced with e-learning. And it's being done in the name of the expansion of access, but it's not. It is in order to cut access to quality learning. And we're replacing very good classroom learning in small communities. Northwest Community College has been very hard hit by cutbacks in funding and by the decline in their economy. And what are they being given in place? They're being given computer terminals and web learning, and that's something A, most of them don't have access to, and if they do, it's not the right type of learning.
One of the things I don't understand about it is distance learning, of course, has been around for 100 years or so, and when I was in college, I had friends who took courses at Ohio State through distance learning, but when they took an exam, they had to go to a secure environment and have it proctored. So much of distance learning now, there seems to be no concern as to who's at the other end of the line. And those exams under strict proctoring are not normally a part of the situation. So I wonder where the house of cards is going to fall down at some place if they don't assure that the person who's getting the credit is the person who's doing the work.